Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, Egg Chasers. It's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously. And what a weekend of rugby. Semi-finals in the Gallagher Premiership, Bledisloe Cup in down south. Is that part of a bigger competition? Rugby Championship, isn't it? They are doing that, are they? Or not?
I think this is just Bledisloe.
Bledisloe 1-4.
Yeah, just Bledisloe.
Yeah, Bledisloe. And Pro 14 rumbles on as well. We've got so much to talk about. That's why we're in the rugby dungeon with you. There's JB in his Sail Sharks vest.
Hello, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And there's Phil.
Hello, Tim. That is a neutrals Sail Shark vest, isn't it?
It's literally just the closest vest that I had to hand. So I threw it on. It gets rather heated in the rugby dungeon occasionally.
It does.
So I thought I'd wear a vest.
So we are at Rugby Podcast on Twitter. We're going to start broadcasting on various places you can broadcast, YouTube, Facebook, the like. So just get following us there and watch this space.
You just need to work out how to do it on camera so it looks like we're apart.
Well, no, because we are...
Just work out the logistics.
The logistics. Yeah. Because we're apart, fitting us all in the shot is a challenge.
It's very challenging because we are...
Yeah, because we're so far apart. That's what I meant. Yeah,
sensibly so socially apart. Distanced. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Precisely.
Yeah. So, so loads of rugby to talk about. How's the rugby going now? I don't know, because we're about to have a situation where...
It's a very broad question.
No. Okay, yeah, you're right.
How's the rugby going?
The rugby's going okay.
So you're still doing the rugby radio show, the radio rugby thing.
I'm just thinking we're on the cusp of, by the time you listen to the podcast, maybe there will have been changes to how our daily lives, particularly where we are in Manchester. Is there any anticipation that that's going to affect rugby on the community level?
So I was in Wales this weekend, obviously going back and forth to the
just being a super spreader, taking it from Manchester to Wales.
Killing grannies and all the rest of it. No, I was working in the Beardmore & Co. offices, and every Friday... after work, me, Beardmore, and Beardmore, so there's obviously four of us there, go out for a beer. And the WRU have cancelled all training. So I know this because a guy who I used to play rugby with works at the bar that we go to. And I wanted to go training on Wednesday because I happened to be in the area then. And yeah, the WRU have said no more training. So up in Manchester... Didsbury Talk H are still training. Preston are still training. You know, everyone of note is still trying. I mean, that's the thing. All these clubs, it feels to me, are really struggling to maintain a sense of normalcy, knowing that probably around the corner is going to be some restrictions.
And it's also, so the restrictions come in is one thing, but it's also, like, if you're training without a specific purpose in mind...
Yeah, totally.
It is... very difficult, whether you're training as a team or whether you're training as an individual. But if you have got a competition or a half marathon or a 10K or anything else... was that a knock on the door?
I thought there was a knock somewhere. Sorry, Phil, I didn't mean to ruin your flow. I was listening intently, go on.
But it probably does just change the dynamic of training a little bit and change the focus little bit, because there is a possibility things could start more normally after Christmas. I think that is very unlikely based on the manoeuvres that have happened so far.
Talking to people around the game, my impression is now that we are getting to a stage where all the excitement has drained out. Like, so we thought it was going to be a November start. All of the... Because we haven't been playing really since March.
So, yeah, not at all, yep, really, so, other than the occasional game of touch.
Yeah, it's touch. So all the excitement was, you know, building. We started playing a bit of contact, and now that is starting to drain away. And this is the dangerous part now, because the Knights are going to draw in. That it's not going to be going out. You know, these are really, if you're part of a rugby team, the real grinding parts are not showing up on a Saturday, and they're not coming to pre-season in summer. That as the Knights draw in, the grind of a Tuesday night and basically some candlesticks rolling around in mud, not being very productive.
When it's pouring down with rain and it's freezing cold.
Exactly. That's when you're going to lose your players. Are you going to do that if you've not got a game on the weekend? If you're not going to, you know, go and compete? I doubt you are. And this is when we're going to face some real difficulties.
Yeah, that is tough.
Yeah. I would consider entering the rugby club into a lower level football league, because at least you can play something.
Yeah, I think you will. We've said it before, but you will get people in the summer. You will have seen people go and play cricket or tennis, and in winter you will see people go and play football, because you can actually have a game. Or when we are speaking right now, you can have a game of football. And I've watched games of football take place near me over this weekend.
Mm. Yeah, look, I mean, if you're in your 20s, not to sound too negative about it all, but if you're in your 20s, it doesn't last particularly long. You don't want to spend a whole winter not playing competitive sport. Go out there and do something else. Well, and, come back when rugby's back on.
Tomorrow morning, I'm going straight to Decathlon, because I'm anticipating that when this news comes in, particularly about Manchester, like, it's all right with Phil with his home gym, but it all got sold out double quick the last time round. And if gyms are shut, which is thought to be part of the Tier 3 restrictions, then I'm getting straight there to get tooled up.
Yeah, I mean, what, you're going to go on a shooting rampage?
I was in Decathlon this weekend. They had some lovely archery sets.
that's what I was going for.
How many shotgun cartridges do you want? I was quite fortunate over the last lockdown. I really assembled quite a lot of workout gear, and that's all at the rugby club now.
So. All you need are kettlebells, isn't it?
Kettlebells, brilliant.
That's it.
Kettlebells.
Barbell.
Yeah,
rack,
that's what
bench.
I'm getting. Barbell.
Somewhere to do chin ups as well.
Barbell and a proper chin up rack is what I'm
getting.
The
gym is the only place, really, where any kind of normalcy exists. So I put it on Twitter as well. I watched the Tottenham Hotspur All or Nothing documentary the other week.
Mm.
No, the other day. And it was like watching sci-fi, like legitimately like watching sci-fi. All these people milling around, drinking wine in corporate before going into, you know, a huge stadium. I thought, God, we're so far away from that. And the gym is the only place that you can go with any type of normalcy, without any stupid face masks. I mean, yeah, you've got to wipe down things and whatnot, but
you should have done that anyway.
Yeah,
if you were sweating.
That's just getting habits that should have been done in the first place. But no, but do you know what was like that for me? Watching Bledisloe, watching New Zealand v Australia. It was weird. Yeah.
How many people did they have in the stadium?
It was full.
Was
so
it?
I think it was like 20
or 30,000.
Yeah, 25,000, something like that.
It was, because it is the Cake Tin, wasn't it? The Sky Stadium, as they said in comms.
Right.
Wellington, home of my beloved Canes. But it was pretty full. There was a lot of people in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was pretty full in the New Zealand dressing room or the Australian dressing room afterwards, when they all got together. Some lovely shots. It was like going back in time.
Yeah.
Seeing all the crowds.
I just realised they didn't social distance, did they?
No, they don't need to.
But how do they need social distance? So what gets me is when they try and social distance on the bench and they don't.
Yeah. I know.
Right. And they've got the mask on, but they've just finished scrimmaging.
There's one set of two pictures I saw on Twitter where it was a football team, I can't remember which, having their team photo taken all 2 metres apart, and then the same players all hugging each other during after a goal.
Yeah.
Do you notice a Wasps player broke some of the rules this week?
Uh-oh. They're going to have a visit from PRL.
They did something very naughty. It might have been Launchbury. He came off and sat on a subs chair with a big red cross on it for social distancing. I nearly took a picture unreported, but I thought, I'll do it to the wider audience on the podcast.
Well, we've just mentioned two games. Which of those would you like to speak of first?
What? Shall we, just before we go into the details of the game, just play back why we had specifically these games and not...
Good call, Phil.
Yeah. An alternative potential.
Good call, Phil, because we talked at length about the outbreak of positive cases at Sale Sharks, and we did all call it right and say we don't think the game will happen.
Yeah.
And it really didn't happen.
And it really didn't happen.
It, There is an element of, for me, of PRL maybe being a little bit antagonistic by announcing the games on the Saturday, knowing full well that this was not going to happen.
Well, it was BT Sport announced the fixtures,
well, and also
with the, but they did announce it with all potential permutations, yeah. And there was some there were some Sale Sharks fans and some neutrals hinting that the games were both on a Saturday to try and pressurise Sale into forfeiting the game because they wouldn't play. But I can say, because we have a Champions Cup final and a Challenge Cup final, that's the reason the games were on a Saturday.
Let's be honest about it. If Sale were playing everything in their hand to pressure PRL, PRL should play everything in their hand to pressure Sale. You know, it is a contentious situation. I don't blame either side for playing every card in their armoury.
But as it is, at last count, and it may well be more by the... I mean,
It may be more, but we won't know because I assume there's going to be no further round of testing
for
Sale.
But... Correct. But at last count, there was 27 positive cases, plus the ones at Northampton and whatever that leads to.
Which has led to Piers Francis and Lewis Ludlam not making it to the England training camp.
Yeah. So, as I said, no one is symptomatic. You don't need to be symptomatic to spread it.
No.
Yeah.
Actually, there might have been one guy at Sale that was symptomatic. But anyway, doesn't really matter.
27 cases is, and plus the ones at Northampton. That's quite a lot.
It is. But as I went back to before, it's like the face mask argument. It's like any argument with this thing, which is you can't rely on the rules in society in general to prevent this thing. It will prevent. Unless everyone is locked up in... Sorry, it will spread. Unless you're locked up in your house, the things can help. But I guarantee you, right, if it's 27 individuals, there will be something blatantly obvious which has gone wrong, but they can still follow the rules and it can still go wrong.
Yes, but I do think that element of trying to understand what happened... Whether it was it was accidental, whether it was negligence, whatever, it's less about going, you're out of order, Sale, or whatever. But it's more going back to what we've just talked about, the community game returning.
Yeah,
all of the testing, and with all of the rules and all of the resources at a professional club, if they follow the rules and can't do it, we've got no chance of getting rugby back.
We have made a rod for our own back.
Yeah,
here.
Big time. Yeah. So, in a funny way, the best thing that could happen. In a funny way, and I don't mean this disrespectfully if you're a Sale fan or a neutral, the best thing that will happen is we find out that there was some mismanagement on Sale's part, because at least then it explains it and you can say, well, that's only happened because of this.
There was a part of the protocols that thought would prevent this kind of thing that Sale adhered to, and it actually hasn't prevented it, and therefore changes can be made.
Young healthy men just play with or without coronavirus. How's that one for you?
Maybe that is the answer. Maybe if you then go and work in a care home or somewhere else, or you're on the deli counter at Sainsbury's, maybe you can't do it for a little while.
You say that, but there are, let's say, a Northampton player who had now can't see their parents, and they would
take up their shift on the deli counter,
or can't go and pick up their 25 grand playing or 20 grand now playing for England, whatever it is. But it's difficult, isn't it? It is a really difficult thing.
You know, if you're a professional rugby player, you don't really get the option to have a private life as well, I'm afraid to say, because you are playing a game, you're playing a sport, you need to be there on time, the show must go on, so on and so forth. Sad fact of life, your work comes first. If you don't want to get paid for it, you don't have to show up, would be my thing. With a community game, it's a bit more difficult. But if you don't want to play, if you think you're going to put someone at risk, I mean, you know, I live with a doctor, so... I guess we're always at risk. It doesn't bother. If someone told me, I've got coronavirus, do you want to play a game of rugby against me right now? I'd say, what, right now? Yeah. The only question would be like logistics of where it is, how do I drive there, and all my studs tight. That would be it.
But there is something in all of this which, like rugby players, professional rugby players within their contracts have conditions around being fit and healthy, not drinking to excess, not smoking, not going bungee jumping, not
skiing.
Riding a motorbike.
The list of things my brother did when he retired. He went straight to ski. I've always wanted to ski. I've never been allowed.
He's a good skier.
Huh?
He doesn't seem to have the body type to be a top skier.
Yeah, but he didn't have the body type to be a professional rugby player. And he was pretty good.
Yeah, he was. Good. A deceptive engine on him. Very deceptive engine.
About the contracts?
Yeah, no, it's just, I don't know, there's something in that, that you have to do things that mean that you are in condition to play rugby, and it does mean, as a professional rugby player, you can't go out taking any risks out in the community. And I'm not for a minute suggesting that's what the Sale players have done, because I've heard from an independent source that they have not done anything at all. Diamond said to Hugo Monier.
I have asked BT Sport. Absolutely everyone, and a lot of people have asked me, have these boys gone out? Were they boozing in the studio? I was like, we would know. We would know pretty quickly. I've not heard a single thing to support that accusation.
So we'll wait and see what comes out of that. But for the benefit of everybody at rugby at all levels, this is an important case that we need to understand what has happened.
Yeah, and just on that point, so I was thinking before about, obviously, that cemented Sale's failure to get into the top four, which you can blame, if you're a Sale fan or a neutral, you can blame that individual point, or you can look across the 8 other losses that they had this season when they travel away to Quinns or at home to Bath late on, when they the things that could have guaranteed. So I was thinking about that, and then I was thinking maybe this is a good time to kind of reflect on the season, because everyone's position is known apart from the top two.
Yep.
And how disappointing or positive this season would be. And I think Sale will be tremendously disappointed not to get the top four again. Because we all said it last season that they, with the squad that they've got, they should have got into the top four. This season, they've got such a good squad. And it will be so disappointing for the squad and Sale fans not to achieve it this year.
Agreed.
So, I had this exact conversation with a mutual friend of ours. And it was exactly that, which is, if you told me that Sale were going to miss out on the top four because of one game against Worcester, well, it's not really about the game against Worcester, is it? It's about, you know, everything else. And that's the same point I made about all the other teams in that top four scramble. Don't leave it to chance. Don't play a second team. Yeah. You know, go and pick up every point you possibly can. And if for one reason that you know, one bonus point for Sale would have made the difference.
Well, on the flip side of that, just the flip side of that particular coin is that. I think it's myself. I thought I was turning Phil up and turning me up. the flip side of that coin is Bristol got there on merit, regardless of what did or didn't happen. Yep. And there were a lot of people, we, between us, questioned Bristol's approach and are they prioritising the wrong thing? And fair play, they got to the top four. However, when they got there, in fact, that was the kind of surprising and a little bit disappointing of the weekend's rugby in general, is just how one-sided these games were, the semi-finals.
Well, I could definitely see the Exeter game getting one-sided because it's Exeter.
Did you see it that one-sided, though? Bath only scoring 6 points.
I never would have imagined it being like that. I didn't expect it to be like that, but I could definitely imagine it getting like that. It doesn't surprise me.
That result is disappointing because I know how much talent is in that Bath squad, but it's still not surprising to me.
Yeah, that's fair.
I definitely saw a beatdown coming in the Wasps-Bristol game, but I expected Bristol to do the beating.
Well, this game was interesting because if you take the Gopeth penalties out early on, which built the Wasps' lead, and if you take that 10-12 minute period from about 55 to 68 minutes, if you take those two things out of the game, these were two evenly matched teams.
Yeah.
And the only reason that Wasps went in with a comfortable lead at half-time, well, there's two reasons. One, Wasps, Jimmy Gopeth kicking penalties, and two, Bristol failing to execute. Both in that first half, they had kickable penalties that they chose to go for the corner and then failed to get returns when they went to the corner.
Yeah.
And that's the thing for Bristol. They didn't build the score. And they didn't. They found themselves far enough behind in the game to think they had to kick to the corner when actually there were still 50 minutes left on the clock and they should have taken kickable penalties.
Finals rugby, totally.
Yeah.
So I have a few problems with this game. Namely, and I know you're going to disagree, but it just wasn't very intense. Now, I don't mean that as a negative. I mean it in a way that I think Wasps have worked out a way to play this game to neutralise what I think Premiership rugby normally is, which is, you know, think about the Bath Exeter is a great example. It's a brutal meat grinder of a game where people smash up and smash up and smash up. And that's kind of how the two teams...
Did you not think that's what it was?
No, I think that Wasps are like... They're like some sort of svelte fighter who punches and then moves, and you can never quite pin them down. Especially, I mean, their defence.
Oh
is,
no,
that's normal Premiership hardcore defence.
Yeah, I was going to say the brutal physicality was from Wasps, and
but in defence.
This is why
I think Wasps are such a good team is. That Wasps team is built for turnovers. And I mean that in two regards.
Yeah.
I mean that both the selection of their outside backs and the speed of their outside backs and inside backs, Dan Robson being one particularly, but also that back row. And that back row, physically in defence and the physicality over the ball, it allows them to force turnovers, and then that's when they're at the most dangerous.
Quite often they're the ones coming in. I mean, Thomas Young and Jack Willis and Brad Shields put in massive hits. I'm not taking that away from them. But quite often, they were coming in and affecting the turnover.
Yeah, yeah. They adequately resourced the ruck to affect the turnover.
After Kieran Brooks, Tommy Taylor tackling.
You're a big fan of him.
You go back and watch that. He just, every time Nathan Hughes had the ball...
What, Kieran Brooks tackling?
Tommy Taylor, just, amazing. Tommy Taylor just... dived at Nathan Hughes' shins.
Yeah, they knew what they were doing.
Absolutely nailed him.
So I think we need to go back a step here. Do you remember, it was you actually, Tim, who told us about Jack Knoll saying something along the lines about Saracen's defence, which is you go after them for six phases and then cracks start to appear.
If they don't score within six phases, then it becomes easy to defend.
Yeah. Oh, was it the other way around?
It was that. I think I think with Saracens, that's how it tended to be, that actually what they tended to do was score within six phases. Yeah. And if you can contain them, then it becomes easier.
The way around.
Saracens are famous for often in big games not wanting the ball.
Yeah.
Saracens
yeah.
want to defend. They will happily defend for 20 phases because they know if you've attacked their line 20 times and failed, the second
Correct.
They get the ball,
Correct.
They are going to score.
Yeah. Correct.
Well, Wasps are not necessarily spending quite as much as Saracens did back in the day. I mean, you know, touch and go whether they are. But my theory on this is that what they're doing on the breakdown allows them to deploy a lot more energy for line speed later on. So you can be nice and aggressive and work incredibly hard if Jack Willis or Youngs takes every seventh ball. Or whatever it may... I mean, it's mostly Willis, let's be honest. Because then you have, you know, you have the penalty, you have a breather, you can walk over to your line-out, you can attack. But when it's time to defend, you know that you'll be defending for, what, six phases or something? And then if you can stop that, then you're good to go again.
Yeah, and Jack Willis is incredible, but him and Thomas Young being able to jackal the way they do is because they're phenomenal specimens, number one, but more so, that is also a consequence of the defence, because Ben Earl had none of it.
I didn't even see him.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's not like you put Ben Earl in the Wasps team, he's all over that ball.
Yeah. But again, it's kind of chicken and the egg, isn't it? Why is it that they're able to turn over the ball? Well, it might be because of the defence, but in my mind, it's because of the continual turnovers they're able to deploy so much energy in defence because they're not working so hard getting back and forth.
And I will say one thing that... in this game in particular, gave Wasps the opportunity to go for those turnovers.
Yeah.
And it was Bristol's failure to identify the risk of men going in ones and twos.
Yeah. Mm.
And they did it. And if you're a Bristol fan, you might have some complaint at some of the refereeing decisions, which is something we might talk about in a second. But you've got to focus your energy on the fact that those Bristol players were letting Nathan Hughes or Ben Earl or whoever it was, Semi Radrada or Siali Piatau, go in on their own, get isolated, and then it was Young or Willis or Shields or Launchbury or Tommy Taylor on top of the ball. And it's as much Bristol, I feel, in this game, was much to blame as Wasps were successful in that regard. And I cannot see Exeter making that same mistake in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, it's a funny psychological game that Wasps can play, because first of all, they didn't really get beaten too many times on the game line early doors, which is difficult then because they're not turning the defence and all the things which come with that. In their attacking phases, their ability to kick the ball tactically must be an absolute nightmare because you're all G'd up, you're ready to go and smash something. Before you know it, the ball is over your head and bouncing somewhere. And you go, oh, bloody hell, right, I've got to turn around now. All my line speed is wasted.
Here I go, yeah.
Trot back. But then, you know, Kipperiggy's running onto it, or there's bloody Fekitoa hunting it down. Or just a nightmare.
Here's Fekitoa. A stat from the BT Sports stats man.
Oh.
That was the lowest gain line success Bristol have had all season.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Interesting. So, yeah, I did admire that. Apart from the last 10 minutes when the game was already over, but that Wasps defence was
immense.
Was really impressive.
It was immense.
Maybe even the most impressive thing about their performance.
Yeah, I totally agree. And from inside the Wasps camp, one of the biggest things that seems to have contributed to that is Pete Atkinson, who, and I think I mentioned him a couple of months ago when I was talking about Wasps resurgence and that I'd heard they were saying how good the fitness guy has been.
Mm.
And being there at the Rico and watching that defensive effort, guys like Kieran Brooks, he makes a tackle. He's on his feet and in the line quicker than... Oh my! It's unreal how quick they are. And then I was on the train home watching the Exeter game and I just seen exactly the same thing from Exeter. Yeah. Those two teams are on their feet and in the line and ready to go again quicker than any other team.
Here's the question for me, and I'm jumping the gun a bit on the subject, but nevertheless, will Wasps be able to play like Wasps if Exeter carry the ball into their back row and they lie on them after contact? I mean, that's the oldest trick in the book. But they're going to suck them in. They're going to play phase after phase after phase. That energy is going to go. It's going to be harder. I mean, Baxter said it. Didn't he? Baxter actually said it. How do you wear down a team? Is it running? No, it's getting the big man up and down off the
down,
floor.
Down, up, down, up.
So, yeah, you can get up and down.
Baxter has an 80-minute mentality, doesn't he? He wants to tie you out over it. He's like, he's planning for 12 rounds all the time.
Yeah.
Actually, the knockout punch comes in about round 7 or 8, normally, for Exeter, in that sort of, as you approach the three-quarter mark.
I think Bristol massively underestimated the fact that they just could not pin down Wasps for long enough to beat them up. And that's what that Wasps defence is about.
It's such a complete performance. Wasps' scrum is so much better.
Yeah, the scrum is amazing.
Their line-out is reliable. Their defence is brilliant. Their driving maul was getting massive success. This is an all-round team.
Gabriel Ogre is a cool player.
Yeah.
I mean, I love him. At hooker, because they had Ogre and Alfie Barbieri on the bench. Yeah.
Stop. Rewind 6 months and you go, the weakness at hooker, Tommy Taylor goes down and they've only got this Ogre fella.
Tom Cruise.
The guy from Stockport, the two back rows that can sort of play-ish. This is never going to work.
And Tommy Taylor, who's been injured for years, it seems.
Yeah, this is a disaster.
Now, they've probably got the squad. I'd say they have got the strongest hooking option in the league.
Yeah,
options, because they've got four of them.
Yeah. I mean, I hope they never have to play all four at once. It wouldn't matter. It would not matter.
Three in the back row. Two in the back row. Barbieri can play 12.
They're like Leicester a few years ago when they had all their hookers. Only Leicester decided to keep all the old, expensive ones.
All the rubbish ones.
not rubbish, but yeah.
Well,
all the old, expensive ones.
All the ones which came bottom of the league this year. All those ones.
And second bottom in the league last year.
Yeah.
To win in a semi-final, as you say, when we were anticipating that being nip and tuck and Bristol having every chance to win, to absolutely hammer them, yeah.
I still have a feeling there's a big loss coming Wasps' way, sadly. I just think that they're not playing... They've like reinvented the game to what they want it to be, and as soon as someone can reinvent it back into what the opposition wants it to be, they're going to get into trouble.
I think Exeter. So one crucial difference between Bristol and Exeter is Bristol do rely on top end talent,
yeah.
And boy, they've got some top end talent. Nathan Hughes, Ben Earl, Radrada. I know Sir Charles Pietau was not playing, but Max Mullins is not a player. Morahan is sensationally talented. They're a really talented team, and I think that's what led Bristol into those ones and twos and getting isolated and turned over as before. Exeter have huge talent, but they are so much more than the sum of their parts.
Yeah.
That I just can't see Exeter making those same mistakes. The bit that will be the problem for Exeter is the fact that they've got three back-to-back-to-back
super important games. And their injuries started to tell in this game a little bit.
Ollie Woodburn, we're waiting to see what happened with him.
Joe Simmons as well.
Joe Simmons, although he did do the interview afterwards and didn't seem too uncomfortable, so you're hoping he comes through with that one. And obviously Jack Knoll wasn't available.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right. The three games back to back is, that's interesting. It is some final, but the Wasps story is remarkable. And you were saying you don't think they can, when a team comes up with something different, they can't match it. I would take you back, and I know it's not Exeter. It isn't Exeter. But I mentioned it last week, that game at the Rec, when Wasps just somehow dogged it out.
Yeah, they found a way to win.
Now,
I mentioned it before in this game about the Bristol failings, and what some fans might suggest was some refereeing failings.
What?
Particularly, and the most obvious, there was a few around the breakdown, which were arguable. There's a few around the scrum. And then probably the most visible and obvious one was the Dan Robson try.
Yeah, well, I'm not really qualified to talk about this. I don't have an opinion.
Well, I think the one good thing about this is it, I mean, I have seen Bristol fans saying that, you know, shoulda, woulda, coulda, if that wasn't given, maybe this, that and the other. I don't think anyone would realistically argue that the result hinged on that decision. But nevertheless, you know, you're talking about the one where Dan Robson took the quick tap penalty.
Quick tap, yeah. Was he in front of the ref or was he behind the ref? Does it matter if he's in front of the ref or behind the ref?
I was having a little... I was just pinging a few texts back and forth with JP Doyle.
Oh, right.
The other day.
Name drop Clang.
As you were saying that, I thought, well, let's... Hold on, let me hit pause on the podcast a second. And there we go, we're back. Phil just brought up the refereeing decision for Matthew Carley on that Dan Robson try, quick tap penalty. Was he chatting to the Bristol pack or not? Got JP Doyle on the line. JP, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing, guys? Are you well?
Very well, thanks, JP. Now, JP, before we get going, I know you're a big fan of the podcast. Probably important that you settle.
I'm an avid listener.
Probably important that you settle a quick argument. Who is your favourite egg chaser?
Well, you see, I obviously had a lot of work dealings with Tim for a long time, and I've had a lot of beers with you, JB, in Philadelphia that time with that game, the Premiership game out there.
Absolutely.
But Phil seems the most normal bloke of you all. Just seems someone who's got life outside rugby. So it's a tough choice. But you know, if I was which guy would I spend the most time with? The guy outside of rugby and the guy who knows this stuff. So I'm going to go with Phil.
Yeah. It's all a facade. It's all absolute facade.
Thank you, JP.
Anyway, on that sour note, let's get going.
Yeah, JP, we wanted to give you a call because we were just debating the Dan Robson try in the Wasps v Bristol game when some fans, and there was quite a lot of Bristol fans, felt a little bit embittered that the try was allowed to have stood because Matt Carley was explaining his decision at the scrum. Dan Robson went and played and he let it go. How do you see that one?
Yeah, it's a brilliant one. It's a real great one, isn't it? And it gives fans a choice of how they want to see it, really. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of reverse the script on you guys. What do you guys think? And then maybe I can fill in with where the law stands and
what was going on
and some other little cues that you might have missed if you watched the footage again. So if I kind of throw it to you for 2 seconds and see what you guys think.
Love it, JP. Well, let's go with your favourite egg chaser first. Go on, Phil.
Yeah.
So... I'm not sure.
So you're the detail. You're the detail man.
Well,
refereeing's about detail. So let's see where you get to on this.
Yeah, it's a very good one for detail. And I'm not sure I have the specific details, but I know I've witnessed 100 times in elite level and lower level rugby that kind of quick tap penalty be called back by a referee because the ball has not been played within the referee's field of vision. But then I'm not sure if that's actually part of the rule or if that is part of the law book or if that is just something that kind of informally takes place and referees either allow or prevent in order to make it a cleaner game. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. No, it is something we see regularly. But
So you're saying crack on, try scored, Phil, or what?
Well, I'm saying If I was to follow the precedents that I've seen 100 times...
No. You're just the referee on the day in that split second.
What do you do?
I probably would have called it back.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to say, right, I'm with Phil. Because, unsurprisingly, I've read none of the laws, but everything I learn is from experience. And experience always says the referee, pre-match, it's like, do you know when you have to look at the airport, you know, the aeroplane boarding, the safety sheets? Like, even though I know what's on those safety sheets, it's mandatory that I look again. So every pre-game chat with the referee is, if you want to do a quick tap, it's fine, but make sure it's in front of me and make sure it's in a metre radius. That is always the chat. Mm-hmm. That said...
Yep.
I've always thought it's a peculiar thing that a team can't just go anyway. It's their advantage. It's their penalty. And I don't think that the opposition should get an advantage.
So what are you saying then? So you would have
saying that my experience tells me that Matt Carley should not have let it go because it's always tap and go. But actually, when I stop and think about it, why should Bristol have an advantage to have it explained when they want to go and play?
So you're doing the Phil role, sitting on the fence.
No. I'm saying, if I gave Wasps and Bristol the pre-match talk, I'd have said, make sure it's in front of me, make sure it's a metre. And then when it actually happened, I go, no, actually, I've changed my mind, because globally, I think this principle is more important.
So you let the try go?
I'd let the try go.
I would have awarded the try for the point of view. I understand what Phil was saying, and that's one thing that occurred to me as well. Matt Carley didn't see Dan Robson take it, but he could have gone and checked that if he had a concern about it. But everything I understand about the way that officiating is attempted to be done is to give advantage and impetus to a team doing something positively. In that occasion, the offence was against Bristol. So as far as I'm concerned, it's the Bristol players' job to see Dan Robson get back 10.
Yeah,
and if they're listening to a referee and not running back to the line, they, you know, that's on them. So I want to reward the positive play, which is Dan Robson and his speed of thought. But I do understand what Phil's saying. Go on, JP.
Okay, so in the model of Ace Ventura, you know, he takes a deep breath to explain at the end. This is sort of where we're going to go for and go for a fight. Okay, so you have to go back a little bit. The reason why all the players were standing around the referee is the intricacy of the penalty. So Nathan Hughes came through the middle of the mall, did brilliantly well, split the mall. But because he split the mall and got on the ball carrier, they broke away. That became open field. He then made a tackle, which he thought was a mall was collapsing because the ball carrier voluntarily went to ground and he went with him, which was legal because now that was open play. He was then penalised for not rolling away when all the players involved thought it was still a maul and it should be a scrum turnover. That was why there was confusion. The ball then spills out underneath, almost nutmegs the referee in a way, and goes directly to Dan Robson. Now, it happens to stay within a metre. It's not a metre radius, because how can it be a metre radius? Because a radius is a circle and you can't be a metre in front, which, or half a metre in front, which the radius would allow you. So it's a metre semicircle, which isn't even true, because you can go back 50 metres backwards and take the penalty if you want.
Yes, you can.
So as long as it's an approximate distance that doesn't disadvantage the opposition, the penalty should be allowed to go forward. In the detail, if you look at Luke Morahan's reaction, he immediately, when the whistle is blown, backs up to the goal line when Dan Robson taps and goes, comes forward, but comes forward too quick. Dan Robson drops the right shoulder and beats him on the outside on the left and scores in the corner, dots it down. The AOR behind can check that the penalty kick was tapped correctly, and he also checked the grounding. It was then double-checked by the TMO to make sure everything was all right in law before it happened. Right, so there's your law.
Yeah,
perfect. And that
is that enough?
Yeah.
But there's more to it. Do you think so? Did Matt Carley engage the Bristol players to explain what had happened, and therefore thus make it more difficult for them to defend? Or did all the Bristol players start asking questions of him, and that's their volition? So there's no reason why Walsh should be stopped from taking a quick free kick and then or a quick penalty kick, and the try stands.
I saw the
it's
latter.
How you want, it's like in everything in rugby, it's how you want to see it. If you want to see that as tap and go, happy days, you infringed. But the infringement was such a small, unlucky infringement. It really was, because Nathan Hughes did so brilliantly to get to the position he got to legally when so many get it wrong and penalised. He did brilliantly, but because the ball carrier was loose, he let go of the ball on the ground after the whistle. So the ball trickled out to the side to directly to Dan Robson, luckily or unluckily, depending on who you support or who you want to win. Tap and go from the mark within a metre behind the mark. How can you, if you pull them back in law, what could you have said to him to say you can't go quickly? But also you could have said, look, I was engaged with all the players. It's not fair. I must give them the opportunity to defend.
Yeah. So
you have to decide what you believe is the correct answer. It seems it seems perfectly legitimate to let the guy score. And the referee even said, in the first half, when Morahan scored in the corner, it was from a quickly taken
turnover by Nathan Hughes,
yes, the same guy. Now, that was taken to the side and in front of Matt Carley, not behind him, but it was taken adjacent as well. The players didn't retreat 10 and they tackled them. Matt Carley signalled penalty advantage, which may or may not, if they hadn't scored, may or may not have resulted in a yellow card for deliberately not back 10. So was it unlucky to score in the corner because they might have got a yellow card there?
Yeah.
Rugby's all about the detail. The detail, the detail, the detail. And it's very difficult. You've almost got to... Refereeing is always about not making the right decision, but making the most understandable decision.
Yeah,
if your grandmother's watching the game, is it fair that Wasp scored, or is it unfair? And that's for the punters to decide.
I love that.
That is
a
great way to put it, isn't it? So I was going to say, I think that there's a stylistic problem here. I mean, it probably needs a directive of all things. But my theory is Matt Carley is a man of great detail, probably too much detail. And I think every decision he made, probably, if you review it, certainly the contentious ones, they're probably right. But they're not necessarily the decision that a lot of other people would make. I'll give you an example. The Harry Thacker hooking the ball penalty. That would be one which probably is technically right.
Well, the free kick. But was that a mistake by the referee, or was that overzealous application of the law? So Harry Thacker did strike. He was penalised for not striking.
Yeah.
Now, is a miss strike the equivalent of not striking, and therefore the referee is right? Or is a miss strike an attempted strike, and it's just he was in a very difficult position, couldn't get his foot back up to get the ball back, well, and it should be a reset?
I would say...
If we reset that, you're criticised for resetting all the time. If you free kick a team on their own ball, and it leads to a penalty 2 minutes later for the opposition, which it did, you're criticised again. Mm. So whichever way you stick or twist.
Mm.
Now, well, if I say to you that every decision is almost criticisable, you have to then say, well, what are you trying to do as a referee? You're just trying to make decisions where, as you said, well, I believe Matt Carley when he makes decisions around the breakdown. So therefore, he is doing a good job refereeing because his job is to monitor what's fair and unfair, not to referee every single law. So if you're believing that that's the type of referee he is, and I watch this game, so therefore I believe this is how he's going to referee, well, that's fair for both teams.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Now, I wouldn't agree with you on, how do you put it there? It's making the game understandable or even getting into the debate, is he wrong or is he right? All I care about is it understandable? Is it defensible? And I'd say every decision that he made was probably defensible. If you review it, yeah, there's a toss-up. Could it be this? Could it be that? But ultimately, he's very rarely flat wrong. Now, I think the upshot of that is, particularly with the Dan Robson try, is there's so much detail. I mean, you've just run through, you know, was it a ruck? Was it a maul? Even seasoned rugby watchers will go, bloody hell, when you put it like that, I didn't realise it was so much detail. He does see it like that. Like a lot of referees, he sees a lot of the detail. And therefore, I think it does need a bit of a directive because you've got the players who aren't entirely sure. So I think the directive needs to come out, which says, yeah, you may ask the referee may talk to you. That said, if the attacking team wants to go, that overrides everything else, and that would be the directive.
Yeah. But
the directive is to answer that. The directive is really simple. The captain, at the right moment, the rule is, because it's not a law, the rule of the game, the rule of the competition, the laws of the game, the rules of the competition. The rules of the competition say the captain, at the right moment, can come up and ask the referee for clarification on the decision so he can tell his team. The referee can go to the captain to get a change. A penalty is not a dead ball situation. The ball is not out of play. So when you're playing under eights, under tens, or you're coaching under eights, under tens, when the whistle go, you say, turn around, face, back 10, turn around, face, be ready, lads.
Yeah.
Why is it any different from under eight to professional rugby? The ball is not dead.
Yes.
I completely agree with that.
The ball is alive.
Completely agree with that.
I love that.
So when you kick the ball into touch, you stay alive until the referee says it's a line out, until the ball is called dead. And then, by sure, go up and have a talk to the ref, ask him, you know, did he have a nice bottle of wine last night? But there's no point getting into it while the ball is still alive.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that is by far
I think you've put that brilliantly. And amazingly, you went through some really, really intricate detail. And the bit I love most out of all of that was, what would your grandma say? I think that's a great way of putting it because... rugby has so many different contexts. It's constantly changing. And I think that's the simplest way to think about it. It did make me think, do you miss, or has it been refreshing not to be the centre of a little Twitter storm after a debatable decision, JP?
It's very difficult because we were in lockdown for so long.
Of course.
I kind of got away from rugby. So it's not like, even though it was mid-season that I got made redundant, it was kind of, I'd been out of the game for 4 or 5 months anyway. So I feel very detached from watching rugby in stadiums that are empty to, you know, the last game I did, which I think was Saracens Leicester. And they're really knocking 10 hails of hay out of each other. So do I miss it? Yes, and I do and I don't. I haven't had the opportunity to miss it yet. But rugby's been my life for so long, since I'm 8 years old, that I'm sure it will. But at the same time, I'm kind of a fan watching as well. I'm still as much of a rugby loser as I ever was. I was sitting down watching Glasgow versus the Scarlets this afternoon, you know, the evening after I watched the golf and before I watched the NFL. So, there's like, you know, as JB says, you know, I'll know who the second string Benetton tighthead is, you know, when they go up against the Dragons next Thursday night or Friday night. Like, that's the sort of detail we live in, because that's the rugby people we are. And we're rugby pigs, and I'm okay with that.
Tell me, JP, I don't mind saying this for all three of us, really, but we miss your presence on the rugby field quite a lot, actually. Was anything signalled to you prior to your redundancy at the RFU, or was it complete? Was it as much of a surprise to you as it was to us?
Well, we knew somebody, one or two or three people were going from our department because we knew it was a company-wide decision. So we knew this was happening, and you always think it could happen to you, but, you know, it's kind of a weird death's man's alley. You know that you're all put on notice that your jobs are up for peril, and then you find out how many you're going, and then it's narrowed down, and you keep thinking, God, I hope it's, you know, you're talking to your mates, you're talking to the other referees, and you're going, well, I hope it's not you, but at the same time, you're thinking, geez, well, I hope it's you before me, because that's life, isn't it? You know, you want to keep your own job, but at the same time, you're not wishing any ill on anyone else. And then it came down, it was me, and I was like, oh, awesome, that's really great news. Cheers for that.
Yeah, thanks.
And you know, as you say, you might miss me, but obviously some people who are making the decisions don't and don't want me to do it, and that's life. Well,
we've had conversations, that's the business of the business. It is the business of the business. But we've had conversations in the past when we were debating like World Cup spots for 2019, and you were on our list. So yeah, as JB says, it was a surprise. It would be such a shame if we didn't see you refereeing, because you still got a lot of miles in the tank yet. But the obvious thing when we heard about it was, well, what are Pro 14 doing? They need to get on the phone. But then we've seen players going to Japan. I don't know if there's referees can go to Japan in the same way, or even if you could take your family there if the opportunity existed.
Look, I think the big thing is refereeing doesn't pay like playing does. You know, you can be a big player and you can go to these places and make a bit of money. It doesn't do the same here. So I have a wife she teaches a good job, and I've got two kids. So it's very difficult to up sticks and leave. I'm a school teacher by trade, so I can quickly get back into that, and I'm doing a bit now. So it's very difficult to do that. The Pro 14 don't hire the referees. They subcontract their match appointments out to countries. So they'll say, right, Ireland, we're going to need four referees from you. Who are you pushing forward for that? Who are your four guys, or your five, or your six, or whatever it may be, guys and girls that are going to do that? And they say, well, these are our guys. So the Pro 14 can't ring me and say, look, we're hiring you. That's not really a possibility. I would have to go join a union. They would have to want to put me ahead of one of their young guys or girls or whatever else. So it's a bit of a close shop, really, but you never know what might happen, but it's a bit tricky that way.
So what is it that the RFU are not doing? And what I mean by that is they've lost a scene.
Well, they're not doing employing me.
But the game still exists. You know, it's not like they've said, we've got one less referee, best have one less game a week. They're still playing the games.
There's always someone to referee the game. You know, say you can't have a game without a referee, but at that level, there's always a referee. The lower levels, maybe not so much, but we are lucky with the professional referees in England. We have a really, really strong bunch. I think, you know, it's probably, I believe, even though I'm on the side of it now, I believe it's the best referee league in the world. Yeah. It has the best set of referees. And I think any league would take en masse and say, well, you've got to take 10 referees from one league. Which one would you take? And I think even with Super Rugby against Pro 14, against Top 14, against everything else, I would think they would be hard pushed not to find a better set of referees than they have in the Premiership. Everyone has, you know, their favourites and their dislikes, and that's fine. That's part of being a fan and a consumer of the sport as well. But I think there's very strong referees, and that's why you can get rid of sods like me, because they have very good referees.
I tell you what, JP, there's going to be some superbly officiated school games soon.
Well, do you know where there's going to be some great officiated games? In Bermuda at the end of the month.
What? What's this news?
Yeah.
So tell us about this phone call and what's going on. What is this new new is TENS tournament? It sounds exciting.
Yeah, so it's the IPL of rugby is what they're trying to set up. And it's almost come at the perfect time. So it was being set up before this, but now they're saying, so they're starting with a tournament in Bermuda over 3 weekends. But they're looking to go to 8 or 9 tournaments next August after the MLR season finishes. And what they'll do is they'll pick up the players who aren't. They'll have 8 franchises or 12 franchises, depending on how things go, independently owned, and they will run a series like the IPL. Instead of like the Sevens, where you're trying to run a whole competition over a weekend, this will be run like a league over 12 weeks, but all the matches will be played at one venue together.
Yeah.
So it'll be just like a big bash every week of 6 or 7 matches or 8 matches with all the teams, all the stars going at it really quick, really fast. Where the why I love the Sevens was brilliant, but day one was almost better than day two because the matches kind of progressed as the day went on in day one, where you ended up with all the fixtures clumped together at the end.
Yes.
The problem with day two was the quarterfinals are on at 10 a.m. in the morning, and then your semifinals are on at 2 o'clock, and then your final is 6:30. It's an awfully long day, so you either miss the quarter or you miss the final, or a lot of the time you just really end up coming between 11 o'clock and 3 o'clock, you know, when the party's on the Sunday, and you don't really see much of it. This will be more a case of you'll see the action because the action's there in front of you. So I was a bit scooby-doobious at the start, but I've come around a long way to what I think it is going to be now. And there's you can see now every day there's more and more people getting involved in it.
So answer me this then. Will the format be all played... will the format be each pair of teams, so in each game, will it only be playing once? Because obviously the rigours of tens are more so than sevens. It's a longer game, more contact.
I'm not sure whether they're going to play... They're going to play 3 weekends, with the final being on the 3rd weekend.
Yeah.
Round 1 and round 2, I think, is the first weekend. And round 3 and knockout game is the 2nd weekend, I think. And then the finals are all played on the last day. So you're kind of getting that progression as it goes through. But it's very much week 1 to week 2 to week 3, which is like a Formula 1 sort of pit stop. It's a kind of a mishmash between Formula 1 and IPL, and that's the way it's going to run. This is kind of the major kickoff event for 3 weeks. But after this, it'll be a week in a city, a week in the next city, and a week in the next city, kind of like the Sevens, but they're not trying to get everything completed in the one weekend.
So from a refereeing point of view, have you done much Sevens in the past? What have you got to change from your 15 style in order to really get a handle on this?
Well, Sevens, I did the World Series Sevens for 2 years and finished at the... I did a gold medal Commonwealth Games match in 2010.
So that's
Australia. They had all their Yeah, so that was in Delhi at the Commonwealth Games. So that was fabulous, and I did the World Sevens final game in Twickenham, Edinburgh, the last two rounds of that year as well, which was the big finals. So I've done my sevens background. I've had my 15s, obviously, and the tens is kind of a hybrid. What would be really cool about the tens is, for you to go from 15 to 7, you have to do so much conditioning. You're going to have to do 3 months or 6 months conditioning. You won't have to do the same going from 15 to 7. A, because they're rolling subs. B, the nature of the game with five forwards and five backs. Mm-hmm. Also, the time period you pay for. And you're not being asked to stop for 4 hours, play another hugely intensive 15-minute game, stop for 4 hours, play another huge 15-minute game. It's a totally different structure build-up. You play your game, and I think there might be a game the next day or the next week or whatever it is. So you're just asked, almost like playing normal rugby, but it's just going to be quicker. So you'll have the sevens guys who have really signed on to this because they're at a bit of a loose end at the moment, aren't they? And then you have the 15 guys who are also kicking around because they're not, maybe there's not as much rugby on at the moment. Their contracts are hard to come by.
I think this is great.
You think of the pots you can pick from, there's quite a lot of player pool you can pick from. Yeah,
100%. And unless you're a freak like Leone Nakarawa, it's so hard to go to jump from 15s to 7s. And I've said this for a long time, that I think 10s was the opportunity missed by World Rugby, because I understand why sevens exists and what it can do for the sport, and particularly in emerging nations, but it actually has ended up, as far as I see it, competing with 15s, whereas I actually think 10s could sit alongside a lot more comfortably, do what they want sevens to do for the game in new markets, but mean that you can actually get Maro Itoje. He could be effective in 10s in a way that he could never be in 7s.
Yeah, correct. You could take Alfie Barbieri from Wasps, the new hotshot, and you could put him in 10s, and he wouldn't have to substantially change his body shape. Where if you're going to take a really up and coming centre, say Ollie Lawrence from Worcester, and you're going to put him into 7s, he's going to have to change that strong, kind of wide, short, physical body shape he has to make him more robust, agile, repeatable sprints. He wouldn't have to do this. And because they have rolling subs, you can bring them on and off. They even have, you can just be an Andy Goode kicker and just roll some Gavin Hastings off the bench just to hit conversions. Like they're doing that as a sort of NFL style, just bring on the special team. You just bring on your kicker, whack the kick from 52 or 62 or 64, and then just goes off again. Why not?
Amazing.
Isn't that cool? I tell you, the pool of players who are going to be very attracted to this will be rugby league guys.
Yeah,
you can pick them up fairly.
But rugby league probably doesn't have a wide enough base where you can pick up South Africans, you can pick up Argentinians, you can pick up Americans, Canadians, you can pick up Pacific Islanders, you can pick up guys from anywhere around the world that are kind of at a loose end or in an off season or you know, not getting enough rugby, and they go, right, we're going to give you 12 weeks here, boom. I can see a lot of the MLR.
And what about this as a thought?
When they finish the season.
What about this as a thought with where rugby's at and the financial situation? Could you imagine a situation? And it's what a great thing to be able to talk about, given everything else going on, that there's fresh money being injected into rugby union from somewhere. So that is a really good news story for rugby at the minute. What about a situation where maybe, let's say, in a couple of years' time, Saracens come back up and one of their big guns says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sign a contract with Saracens to play Heineken Cup rugby. I'll play for the RFU. I'll be with the RFU playing for England. And the rest of the time, I might do 3 months in Japan this season. I might do 3 months in the new Tens tournament.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, well, you could, it would be lovely to imagine that someone could get, like, you could go MLR, then you could go into the Tens. Then you could come over. That would finish in October. You could come over, pick up a 6 month contract, play in whatever level, depending how good you are, in the UK, or in France, because you could come over in November. You could play, pick up a 6 month contract, and then go back to the MLR, and then go back on the tens, and you're just traveling, following the sun, having a great time.
Yeah, exactly. We've spoken in the past about the
kind without having the seven style, physical needs,
without the seven style conditioning. But we've spoken in the past about the value, how valuable it is to have players available mid-season, good players available mid-season, in case a club gets a horrendous spate of injuries in, say, second row or back row or the centre. And this, it just gives the opportunity for more players to be playing at a high level round the world. So It's got to be a good thing.
Yeah. And more opportunities when this damn coronavirus is out the way for road trips, by the sound of it. Bermuda well, would have been lovely.
Point, yeah, it could be JB's tier 2 tours to Bermuda.
Exactly. So have you got a list of places you would like to see the Tens? Because I have a very, very clear list of places where I'd like to see.
All of them have drinking at altitude.
Yes.
Rooftop bars.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. I think the places they're looking at, and I don't think anything's confirmed yet, but I think they're looking at Mauritius and New York.
Good.
Seattle, Dallas.
Good.
Los Angeles. Maybe a Cape Town one. Maybe Buenos Aires one as well. Something along those lines.
Nice.
I would do a
But again, it's all, it's a bit up in the air at the moment. But I think they're looking at North America. No, they're looking at North America for the investment. With the franchises, because they just need 8 or 12 franchises, and they're going to move them around the city there. So for me, yeah, I'd like to base myself in Ottawa with my family, and yeah, I'm up for, I wouldn't say I'm up for rent, but I'm available to go do what they need.
Well, I would say, well, I mean, I think a perfect job for you, JP, would be head of officiating done remotely. And then you can fly out as and when, you know, as you see a big game that needs your attention, you could fly out and then, you know, supervise the officiating crew from the sideline. That seems perfect. Oh,
that sounds great. You mean if I see anyone having too much fun, just get over there immediately and stop them?
Well, I mean, we can dress it up differently, but yeah, effectively.
Or get involved.
Yeah, I think we should add Ibiza to the list. I think we should add Barcelona to the list. I think as well there should be an event during a ski season somewhere.
Ooh.
Yeah, so, you know, somewhere...
Well, like, there is snow. There is ones in teens and stuff. There is the snow fives and stuff.
Yeah, there is. So that used to be...
places like teens and stuff, yeah, but...
They could do a Salt Lake City-San Francisco hybrid one. That's only about an hour and a half away from each, a couple of hours away from each other.
There was a tournament organised, and I think that's the one that JP's referring to there, which was organised by... the ex-French international Gorbachev. And it's like the six resort and they go around different resorts and play in snow. There definitely has to be that.
Awesome,
love it. Oh, well, again, just to
I think that's more for senior boys drinking port though.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know,
they still need referees.
They need referees, and I think, you know, it's just one of them.
Well, JP, I insist that you do a little email introduction with the bosses of this new venture, because it sounds like exciting times ahead.
Yeah, what's the pitch side reporting game there like, JP? Are they looking for some real talent?
They've announced Painter.
Sorry, you can say his name. It's fine. It's not Voldemort. Alex Payne. He's a lovely man.
No, yeah, Alex Payne. I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember his first name. Alex Payne. Is doing it. The girl from is it Loza or Lisa from South Africa? She's a super sport girl.
Elma.
Elma Smith.
And yeah. Elma. That's the lady. Elma. I haven't met her yet, but I've heard her doing her stuff on the sideline.
Oh, excellent.
And they've got Nick Heath commentating.
Yep.
And it's going to be. I'm pretty sure it's going to be shown on television here. I just think they're waiting to announce. I don't want to say anything that's out of my place, but I believe it's going to be shown. So it's just a matter of announcing or signing the deal. So you will see it, which is very exciting as well.
That is exciting.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Do you know one of the most pleasing things from this chat, JP, is that you still watch the rugby? Because I know it's not exactly the same, but when Chris Moyles nicked my radio job and I got fired, I found it really hard to listen to that station.
Yeah, we all did, Tim.
Yeah, I still don't listen to it. On your behalf, Tim.
Thank you, Phil. Appreciate that.
I'll leverage it. It is hard sometimes to watch it. It's pretty much heartbreaking. But at the same time, you've been a rugby nose from the age of seven. You're going to, you know, my interest is not refereeing, it's rugby at the end of the day.
Mm.
You know, I dislike referees as much as the next guy when I'm watching, when I'm supporting a team. So, you know, you're watching rugby, you're not watching the ref, and that's the way it should be.
Mm. Yeah, well
said.
Hopefully we'll see you on the sidelines for Didsbury Talk H sooner rather than later, as soon as this pandemic is over.
Yeah, sounds good.
Just a quick thought then, as we've got your expertise at your head, just the Champions Cup final, how do you see that one panning out?
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one, isn't it? Because of the dichotomy between the two teams, you've got power versus panache. That's not to say that the Parisians don't have the power, because they do. You've got Nigel Owens refereeing it, so his style, who will that lend towards? That'll probably lend him maybe a bit towards Rassing, because he might let it flow a bit more. He mightn't be as you know, if the spectrum is from Stickley to Jouet, he might be more lenient that way. But at the same time, he'll have to certainly put his stamp on the game. So you would think that it'll come down to who. I always think with the likes of Exeter and the likes of Saracens and the likes of the big French teams, you know, or even Munster when you look at them, it's the 3-6-9 game, isn't it? So if in the first half the team who play with power can go 3-6-9, they have a very good chance of getting to 16, beat through a mistake from the opposition, and then there's a big chase on. But if it stays level, you would expect the Parisians to pull out, Racing Metro to pull out some sort of Jouet like they did last time. But if it stays in an arm wrestle, you would say Exeter will put the points slowly on the board, a la Saracens, a la Munster, even Leinster when they're playing that way. So that's the way you would see it going. I always think rugby comes down to, if there's no intercept and there's no red card and there's no big moment, you would fancy Exeter. But if there is a bit of something that happens, wow, that's crazy, like Racing did in the semi-final, you would go with them. So it's really about, on the day, how that first 15 minutes goes, and then after that first 15 minutes, you should be able to see who the winner is, I think.
So you're happily sitting on the fence then, JP, just like me?
Yeah, I on this one, because of the nature of the game. And I'm sure, I haven't looked at the bookie line, but I'm sure it would be somewhere around, you know, a point or two to either team because of the nature of it is.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I'd get a 50-50 split. It really is the dichotomy of the two. Both teams have the ability to beat each other. And Bristol, it's a big pitch. It depends on the weather, doesn't it? It depends on how the weather comes in. If the weather comes in heavy, well, then that fancies Exeter. It's a really, really quick pitch there. It's a big pitch. So that helps the Parisians. It's in near Exeter. That helps them. So it's there's no crowd, so that helps the Racing Metro team. So literally every time you weigh up a factor, it goes one or the other. Like, my deciding factor was the stash for Racing Metro is far better than the stash of Exeter.
I mean, so it really is. It's not really, you know, really close, is it? And if Racing ever pull out
any team that drinks champagne at half time and wears a pink dicky bow at half time,
absolutely.
And in one final, they came out in white blazers. I mean, that's superb.
Mm. Yeah, it's all Eden Park. So it's all Frank Manel when he was playing for them. He, in 1982, he were there in the cup final, and they brought butlers out with champagne at halftime, and they lined up to meet the president in their pink bow ties. And that's where Eden Park clothing came from that French cup final.
Phenomenal.
What a great fact. JP, it was really lovely to talk to you, mate.
No worries.
And, let's chat again soon. More importantly, when we can, let's have some drinks soon.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's good.
You take care, JP, and enjoy Bermuda.
Cheers, guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Right.
Beautiful.
Press M.
M. Nice. There you go. We'll put that in there. That's there. What a lovely bloke.
Such a top bloke.
My favourite non-premiership referee. And by the way, when he was at the Premiership, he was my favourite premiership referee.
Yeah. And a top boy. Big fan of all of us, some more than others, of course.
Yeah.
And big fan of having beers in Philadelphia. Who isn't?
Huge fan of that.
I missed that.
You'd have loved it, you know. I always think about that trip. I think the one person who'd loved this more than anyone would have been Tim.
When we were there, you kept saying it, JB.
I kept saying it.
When we were drinking in the VIP lounge at the stadium.
With JB.
When we were drinking
Doyle.
In the rooftop bar.
Yeah.
When we were drinking with all the Saracens players.
When we're watching Oxford University do a rendition of their songs, all on chairs.
Every PhD time.
Singing everywhere, and I thought Tim would love this.
You kept on nudging me and saying Tim would love this.
Yeah.
Tim really would be loving this.
We were at Terminal Market.
Yeah, we were watching the NFL. You were having some cheese steak and some
and oysters. And as every oyster slid down my throat, I thought Tim would love this.
The oysters and champagne that we had.
Yes.
Oh yeah. God, you would have loved that.
How was your Philly cheesesteak? I've never had one.
What is it?
It's good. It's a bit like it is very thinly sliced steak. Almost like a doner meat type thinness to it, with then a very rich and creamy cheese sauce on it,
yeah.
And it's like fried onions and a few other bits and pieces. We had that with some Lagunitas, didn't we, when we just arrived?
What a day. We just watched NFL. This is a day after the Premiership game, after Newcastle versus Saracens, which we gave a courtesy watch to. I mean, we didn't watch it all, admittedly.
I'm not surprised about that. Having gone all the way to Rome to watch... and I've never seen New Zealand before. I've mentioned this before on the podcast. JB was so into the entertainment you can have in Rome that we missed the haka. And then...
We only just got into the stadium. They were closing up,
letting you into the stadium. So I missed the haka, and then... By half time, Jamie's like, should we just go into town?
Well, to be fair, we stayed within the stadium for quite a while, drinking their complimentary Prosecco.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's a hell of a stadium.
Yeah.
And do you know what? I thought maybe this is the one for Italy. They reeled off the players. Benetton were doing well. Sergio was still playing.
Yeah.
Maybe not his height, but he was still playing. And within 10 minutes, it was quite obvious this was not going to be a real game.
When the crowd was doing a Mexican wave 10 minutes in and the All Blacks are 21-0 up.
Yeah.
Oh, I just want coronavirus to go away so we can have more trips to Bermuda or wherever else these 10 series will be, to Tier 2 and all the rest of it, please.
Anywhere.
Anywhere. Please. But we were just talking about the Champions Cup final. Before we get onto that, let's dovetail into Exeter that JP was just talking about, and the semi-final beatdown that they gave Bath.
Yeah, it was so predictably Exeter Chiefs that, I mean, it was a brilliant performance by Exeter all round, and the way that they fronted up in the forwards, in the pack, all round in the pack, and the way that they were smart enough and controlled the game in the backs, and particularly... Stuart Hogg, who we all know has got he's got an incredible boot, he's got a powerful boot, and he's got an incredible turn of pace. Mm. I can't really remember him doing a huge amount in the past was how intelligently he chose to whether to kick or run, and then how intelligently he actually executed his kick returns into space to constantly pin Bath back into their own half and their own 22.
Yeah, it's an important point, that, isn't it? Because the world superstars of the game, we think of because they're very good at the flash things. And it's actually the bread and butter stuff which gets you trophies. And I think Stuart Hogg is a great example.
And to speak on Exeter to that end, I was thinking about this, and this is how good Exeter are. They've just hammered a team in the semi-final of a Premiership. They're in a Champions Cup final and a Premiership final. And if you were picking a Premiership Team of the Year, I think you'd... Well, we'll wait and see what the BT Sport Premiership Team of the Year is. All the guys are putting their heads together and coming up with a 15. But I would think there'll be a couple of Exeter Chiefs.
Yeah, one or two.
Cowan-Dickie at hooker.
Yeah, Cowan-Dickie should be in there.
Johnny Hill at lock would be another one, potentially. But who else? Sam Simmons.
Simmons,
so maybe three in the pack, but none in the back line.
Possibly Hogg.
I don't know.
Well, Hogg's a sexy enough name to put in a team of the year. I mean,
he is
stardust. Wow.
Has he been the best fullback in the? I think Piatel's been a better fullback in the Premiership.
Yeah, perhaps. But
that's not that he's been bad. He hasn't been bad. But this is exactly my point. But the point I'm making is that's how good Exeter are. They're so good that they don't rely, like Bristol, on individual talent, even though they have individual talent. They don't rely on it.
So, yeah. Joe Simmons is a classic example. The guy captains the best team in the country.
Yeah.
And I don't think he'll even get the slightest nod for team of the year.
He probably won't. But, just in this game, so the two late tries, or later, the two second-half tries, the hog try, where he drops his shoulder on Jonathan Joseph, who is a very good...
Oh, I couldn't believe that happened.
I know. He rolled him back. It wasn't... There was just something to it. He just kind of a half show, dropped the shoulder, rolls through, offload hog in the corner. There was that, and for the Devoto try.
Oh, yeah.
Where he breaks. So both of those. I mean, I'm trying to think. Like we spoke the other week about comparing him to, is he more of a Farrell, is he more of a Ford?
Bit of both.
I'd say neither of those two could have manufactured those two tries.
No,
that's a great shout, Phil.
And he's been class. That's a great shout. He should definitely be in the conversation for England as well, because he just. I mean, to get him past those two would be something. But he is playing some phenomenal stuff at the moment.
Yeah, just go back to Jonathan Joseph thing. I have genuinely never seen Jonathan Joseph being treated like that as a defender.
Oh yeah,
no, and he's played much bigger. He's played against much much bigger players than Joe Simmons.
I mean, by rights, that Exeter team should not have won against that Bath team. Like, just take the shirts off, right? Just think about who, like,
the talent.
Yeah, like
Watson, Joseph, Thokunosinga. Yeah,
I mean, even at fly half, right? If you asked, when you put the shirts on them, you'd always say Joe Simmons. But if you just got the average guy on the street and said, rank the top 20 fly halves in the world, you would probably get Priestland in there. Most people that watch international rugby would never come up with Joe Simmons. But Joe Simmons is clearly a much better player.
Yeah.
Clearly.
And miles better as well.
So, Bath were... Well, they were very Bathish. incredibly powerful. Very good team. And I think the performance they put in would probably beat a lot of other teams. Because the first 10 minutes, they were all over Exeter. And that was the difference. They punched themselves out early. But if they were playing, I don't know, any other random team in the league, they'd probably get a try. They'd probably get two tries. The complexion of the game looks completely different, and it sorts itself out from there. Well, they threw everything at Exeter, and they couldn't get through. And then when Exeter score their try, their counterpunch, I think heads just start to go down then.
Yeah, and the way that Exeter scored those counterpunches
Brutal through the middle.
Yeah, and you get, once they're in your 22... It's just how long you can hold them out for, because you're not going to stop them.
Yeah.
They are getting over your line one way or another, be it Cowan Dickey or Johnny Hill or Sam Simmons or one of their mutant South African or Namibian or Zimbabwean.
Whatever
back
they
rows.
Get.
Yeah. One of their sub-Saharan African back
generic,
rows.
Generic African back rows. Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, they were absolutely brutal. I'm very upset with Bath that they couldn't get that early score, because I think that does change things a little bit. They still lose.
But if they, as JP was saying, the 3-6-9, if you start to build those points, so they got two penalties relatively early, if they'd added a try to those two penalties relatively early on, then all of a sudden there's doubts in Exeter's mind as to, hang on a minute, we're now chasing the game. And teams do strange things. They make bad decisions when you start chasing the game.
Everyone has a plan until you punch them in the face.
Exactly. And sadly, Bath, they got close to bloodying Exeter's nose, but they never quite did it.
Yeah, and I love the point that was being made in commentary, which is Bath are doing nothing wrong. Exeter are just that good. Like the pick and drive, 5 metres out from a line, we've seen it for season after season now, and I'm sure every coach at every other team that play against Exeter go, right, this week we are just going to find a way. You can't.
Well, you can. You can take the ball away from them before they go on the pick and drives. And this is the fascinating thing about Wasps. So if Wasps can dominate the breakdown, which I'm pretty sure they can't, because if I wanted to dominate Wasps' breakdown dominators, I would almost certainly pick an Exeter-style attack with that triangle of carriers when they go in pick and go, so I can run into a Willis, keep him on the ground, ruck over him, and then don't let him up. Just literally do not let him up. and I'd do that over and over again. That said, if Willis and co. can take the ball away before they get up ahead of steam, before they get into that 5 metre yeah. channel, well, then we've got a bit of a different game.
But all the people saying extra boring and stuff,
no,
they do that.
They are not boring.
They do that efficient 5 metre out, relentless try scoring. But the play they.
But why is that boring?
The play,
Removing someone's soul is not, it's not boring.
Regardless, the play they used to get there is incredible. And that Devoto try that you've already mentioned, Phil,
that is not
was
boring.
One of the best tries this season. And
is it bad? I can't remember
many seasons. So good.
Oh, it's the...
Started in their own half, about three phases in total, but brilliant handling, real quick recycling of the ball, and then Joe Simmons, that offload off the deck.
Genuinely can't remember it.
That was it, Joe Simmons. It was a team try, finished by Devoto, but executed by Joe Simmons. And that for the hog try, where Joe Simmons drops the shoulder. Those are two world class tries.
Yeah, they really are.
Brilliant.
They really are.
And Exeter are not boring.
Do you know what else wasn't boring?
Tell me.
The free rugby we got at the end of Bledisloe 1.
Oh, I love free rugby.
I love free rugby. I didn't even know the game was on, so...
But you'd be forgiven for missing it live, because was it a
3 a.m. coverage started. Although,
wow,
actually, 4 a.m. when the game kicked off, they had a full hour of build-up, and I watched some of the build-up. It's a little bit bonkers, the build-up. A lot of it is exactly the same as the coverage you get in the UK. Some of it, they've got Joe Wheeler and Izzy Dagg as a little sort of comedy duo.
Who's Joe Wheeler?
I assume he must have played rugby at some point.
Joey Wheels.
Joey Wheels.
You don't know Joey Wheels?
J Wheels.
He has been playing in Japan for a period of time. Oh, played. Yeah. He's a genuine super rugby player.
Is he funnier than the Honey Badger?
No.
Yeah, but isn't it... You know the Honey Badger's been caught out with his little jibes?
Has he?
What?
Yeah, so someone gave an example.
Oh, he's not PC enough anymore, is that it?
No, far from it. Joey comes out with what sounds like the Everyman. Oh, I was, you know,
busier than a one-armed bricklayer in Baghdad.
Yeah, but that's an organic funny quip. Turns out quite a lot of them they've come from elsewhere.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I don't doubt that. I don't really care.
Yeah, it's the delivery, isn't it, that counts.
He does have good comic timing.
I'll be going off like a cat snake when I'll get my first meat pie.
Yeah, to be fair, cat snake, I can imagine people from where he is from saying stuff like that. Lots of things like cat snakes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Rooster. He's a tough rooster. I can imagine that.
But the tough as woodpecker lips.
It's a good line.
So anyway, they had a full hour's build-up, but the game itself was... I mean, you talk about intense matches.
Yeah.
And fair play, Dave Rennie. Because you looked at the Australian lineup, and a bunch of it. It was like a couple of years ago when I started, you know, turn on England cricket team and go,
who's that?
I don't know half these
who's
names.
Who's that?
Like Tom Banks, the fullback.
Yeah, Brumby's Tom Banks. We did mention him potentially being in the World Cup squad because
he
had a good season that
it's
year.
It's funny, you watch these players.
The guy that...
Oh, right winger.
Dagunu, who is class. He plays for the Reds
class,
now.
Yeah.
The guy that I didn't know at all was Harry Wilson six.
I've mentioned him before, but I didn't mention him because I went, what a player. I mentioned him because he was the guy that in Super Rugby I saw with the shortest shorts ever.
Oh.
And he wore very, very small shorts again, but he was awesome.
And good lad.
He balances that back row.
Totally.
Because Hooper and Pete Samu, who most people will know, they are very good players, but neither one of them is particularly big. Whereas he is he's only 20 years old, and he is a big slice, a big strong boy with a good engine on him.
And Taniela Tupu had an absolutely awesome game, given the tight head shirt to start this time. And so you had quite a lot of players on debut. You had James O'Connor at fly half. And
who had a great game.
Who had a really good game.
Really good. Apart from, I will say, if he could have kicked sticks a little better than he had done, which was actually true of both teams, because Jordy Barrett, who is a phenomenal kicker, didn't have the best day kicking sticks. Now, it was awful conditions, raining horrendously.
But I don't think the goal kicks for James O'Connor, you'll think... if he could have added that as well. But he did play brilliantly, as you said.
Yeah.
But the reason why, well, both teams I think will legitimately be coming away going, we really should have put that one away.
We should have won that. Well, New Zealand, had Rico Ioane not done his trademark one-handed dive and put the ball down in torrential rain conditions and dropped it over the line,
no one
within 10 yards of him.
No.
And he drops the ball. It was a stupid turnover.
It was a classic Rico Ioane try, in as much as all he had to do was catch the ball and put it down.
Can I just say,
running yards.
We could have legitimately scored the
this
try.
This is when the rot starts to set in. So this is it. Because that is unacceptable. By All Black standard, they would never have done that.
So that that was on the stroke of half time when he goes over and fails to dot the ball down.
And New Zealand are 9-3 or something?
No,
like
it was 13-3. That would have made it 20 points to 3. New Zealand, 20 points to 3 up at half time.
Or at least 18-3.
Yeah, it would have been an easy conversion because he wasn't right on the sticks.
Yeah,
there was
right.
No one around him. It should have been 20 points to 3. It's game over. And then missing that, and then fair play to Australia, the way they started the second half, and the way they played for the whole of the second half, they were the better team.
Tell you what, I'm looking at these teams, and I can't believe it was a draw.
I know.
I mean, they've even got naturalised Irishman, Shannon Frizzell, playing for them. and when he plays, it seems like there's like eight of him. He's everywhere.
And Ardie Surveyor playing at number 8.
New Zealand won't be looking at the game tape thinking we played really badly.
What we say then? Foster out.
Fozzie out.
On game one. Well, no, like
gotta
you say, game was done at half-time if Rico Ioane does the most basic thing that would be expected of any rugby player at any level, let alone on the highest stage of all. He absolutely blew it.
And normally, New Zealand in the second half, because they are just historically fitter than every other team, they normally pull away. And they're clearly not fitter than this Australia team. They could not pull away at all.
I will add one little caveat. Rico Ioane's foot was in touch for the first try.
For the first try as well. Yeah, you are right. And it didn't get spotted.
And it didn't get spotted.
The touch judge should have spotted it because he was right there.
Looking at it.
The touch judge.
And he was an Aussie as well. He was Angus Gardner.
Yeah.
The TJ, so...
Yeah, and that was for the Geordie Barrett try 10 minutes in.
But the ending was bonkers. If you just watch the last... Just watch from, like, 79 minutes, JB. You'll get 10 minutes of rugby, and it'll be so exciting.
Even watch from... It's about 71 where Geordie Barrett misses a penalty with about 8 minutes to go.
Yes.
And then James O'Connor slots a penalty a couple of minutes later. Then Geordie Barrett, with 1 minute to go, levels it up. And with no minutes left on the clock, 81 minutes on the clock,
Reece Hodge
gets a shot of goal from, in comms they said 55, 56 metres. I think it's even further than that. It was
against the wind.
On the halfway line, to the side, closer to the 15-metre line than the middle, and at least 5 metres back past the halfway line in his own half. So it's closer to 60 metres than 50 metres.
And distance wasn't an issue.
He hits the top of the post from that distance. That would have travelled 90 metres, that kick.
With all that.
That was an absolutely ridiculous kick, but that sparks just total insanity because he fails to score that. New Zealand fail to gather it, and then Australia have the ball in New Zealand's 22 with no time left on the clock. And how New Zealand do not give away a penalty, how the ref does not give a penalty against New Zealand.
Sototu was all over the ball.
But then New Zealand steal it, and they're not accepting a draw at home.
Yeah.
Even though the conditions are horrendous. So from their own 5 metre line, it's Hoskins Sototu again, does a basketball chest pass out to Caleb Clark. Who looked so explosive. And it just went from there, and New Zealand went 95 metres only to turn over the ball and have, on the 89th minute, full-time blowed.
And not a single penalty and not a single breakdown in between the two try lines. when you had Australia camped on New Zealand and then New Zealand on Australia. Bonkers game.
Magnificent.
It was so good.
Go back and rewatch that.
You should, yeah. It's definitely worth watching.
Even if James O'Connor, bloody hell. I mean...
The breathing works.
He had 2 years to do something over in Manchester. Well, why couldn't you have done this in Manchester?
Because you didn't have...
Dave Rennie as his coach.
Or Corabetti and Dalgouni playing outside him.
Yeah, better, you'd argue.
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure.
Those boys.
I mean, they didn't even think he was... they signed him as a 10. They had a look at him like, not a 10.
Not a 10.
I'd argue that he wasn't a 10 for the longest time. Bloody hell.
Fair play, because he is...
a waste of money.
I remember looking at him in the past and thinking... he's out of shape. He's basically lost it, and he's got himself. He looks in tremendous shape. His feet look good. His distribution looks good when he's not throwing intercepts like he did in Super Rugby AU occasionally. But
it's been on. I hate to use this word because I'm sure he'll be using it himself. A journey.
He has been on a journey. Well,
he showed up at Sale and he was in great shape, and then he put on a lot of weight. But it wasn't. It wasn't good weight, but it wasn't bad weight. What I mean
it
by
wasn't
that is,
all bad weight.
Yeah, it was purpose. The purpose behind it is you didn't want to get so injured.
And you wanted to play 12 or 13.
Yeah, and you just needed a little bit more bulk because it's a Premiership. And then, you know, he was doing something right, because when they went over to La Rochelle, he was the absolute boy. So he'd slowly found his form, and then Australia came back in for him because Australia were absolutely decimated. Said, right, come home. And from then, he's just taken his opportunity and built.
He has. And in this game, having Tamua outside him and Nick White inside him, who are both classy operators.
Nick White was so good.
Yeah.
He's a good player, though, isn't he?
I was watching this thinking, so he was steppy and his passing fizzed and he was keeping the defenders honest.
And that pass for the Australia, for the Corabetti try was ridiculous. Or Dalgouni, I can't remember.
That was the Dalgouni one. Yeah. The thinking of that. To react, get there, and flick it out the back. But he Nick White's an interesting one because he's... I almost think he was wasted at Exeter. Because Exeter do not need... They do not need a... He would have been on... I'm going to just pluck a number out of the air. He would have been on 300k, something like that. He would have big money, international signing. They got him from Montpellier. Montpellier play... they pay a little bit for their boys.
Occasionally. Now, did he not go back to Montpellier?
No,
he went from
Exeter to Brumbies.
That's right.
But he was sadly wasted at Exeter, even though they were so successful with him there, because they only needed kind of 30% of his skill set.
Do you remember the game?
Fair shout.
Here's a true story. I was talking to one of the England... Well, a coach that used to work with in England 16s, and he's very, very much invested into development of rugby. Mm. And he was saying, like, you know, Russell Earnshaw, and I will drop that name,
Clang,
would be designing these development pathways for these young lads to play, and they'd be getting all these skills and all these attributes, and they'd be phenomenal at the things they do. And they get to a Premiership team and they go, we don't need you to do that, or that. Can you kick? And that'd be it. Like, you know, they're using 25% of their skill sets. Maybe the moral of the story there is only train them up on 25% of the skill set. I don't know.
But then the argument is what I've heard Eddie Jones say, which is like in England particularly they did robots, and this is probably a dig more at the Premiership clubs rather than the Russell Earnshaw type skill set, which is guys don't think for themselves. And England and Eddie Jones saw it with the Fox against Italy, where you put an unusual problem in front of them and they can't think their way around it. They can try and run through it. But
the funny thing about Foxgate is we talk about it like they lost
50 points.
But, I think they solved it.
But it showed up huge failings in that England camp. And I think Eddie Jones would... Well, I'm pretty certain I've heard him admit as such. England were always going to win that game. England were never going to lose that game. Mm. It was just how badly they played in the first half of that game.
So
Nick White, do you remember the game when Nick White basically carried the ball more than any other player against...
Yeah.
There was one game where they had this really unusual...
2 years ago, or last year.
A really unusual strategy of Nick White literally picking every time he could, right through the middle of New Zealand. They might have won, actually.
Yeah, I think they did win that game.
It's like so ridiculous. Like 20 carries. It was ridiculous.
Last year.
So how old is Michael Hooper now?
30.
He's 30 and he's just got his 100th international cap.
Is he even 30? He
might 27, isn't he?
He might not even be 30. Let me just...
He's not as young as 27.
I've got a feeling 27.
100 caps. It's
He'll be pushing George North soon.
He is 28.
Oh my god!
In fairness to him, he is 29 in 2.5 weeks' time.
There we go.
Still,
that is ridiculous.
100 caps, age 28,
and
that is mental.
That is crazy.
He's a hell of a player.
George North has got, I reckon, 80 caps.
George North, well, George North and Hoops, I'm sure they're the same age. As they're born within 6 months of one another. Because they were both on the trajectory to be the most cap player of all time at age 24 or 25.
Richie or Alan Wynn now. No, when's Alan Wynn get it?
I want to say 147 for Richie.
Yeah. Mind you, that's still a hell of a lot of caps to go
through.
That's
still a lot to go through, isn't it? Particularly when there's no international rugby.
And with Richie McCaw, who's got, I think, higher than 90% win ratio, which Hooper cannot claim that he has.
You'd have to win a lot of games from now until the day he retires.
But just
148 for New Zealand is
what's
Richie.
What's his winning percentage, Hooper? And then, maths, how many games would he need to win?
He'd have to play until he's like 300 games based on his current winning percentage.
Doesn't the world just feel right with a good Australia team?
It feels like there's a weight off your shoulders that rugby might not die instantly. Yeah.
Yeah.
A good France team and a good Australia team.
Because South Africa for a period of about 8 years over the last 10 years.
Oh, yeah, with under
in
Peter
between
de
their two World Cup. Yeah.
I wonder how bad they really are, though. Oh, did we just get hysterical about it? Because.
No, they weren't good.
They weren't good, were they? I agree with that. But maybe they were good. I mean. Maybe the teams that were better than them were just much, much better.
The guys on the Green and Gold podcast stopped doing little two-way podcasts with us because they were...
they wouldn't answer the phone, guys. So, maybe. But it looks like Brenny's doing the job.
Yeah, have Scotland missed a trick there?
100%. Yeah. Wouldn't be like Scotland to miss a trick. Hey, have I done a Lamborghini that parks at my gym? And the number plate on this Lamborghini is SRU1. And I thought that's hilarious because legitimately the only person in rugby that could afford that would have been Mark Dobson.
Dodson.
Straight after his 900k, or whatever it was, 300k. What was it?
Player I saw. Oh, I can't say.
Yeah, you can. Go
no,
on.
I
Tell
can't.
Me about the Premiership player that you know.
No, the number plate that a Premiership player has. Well, I don't want to say it, even the plate, which is obvious.
That's it, surely.
No, I'm
you
not
can't. You
it.
Can't give that one off the card problem with that.
Not fair to it. Anyway,
I'm looking up the. Actually, really caught. Blow, he was 89.2 win 18, ratio. 89.2. McCaw is 50-50. Not McCaw. Hoop is 50-50.
Wow.
He has
not a win. In sessions, he would have done better.
So if Hooper was to win... Oh, no, because that's not even good. He said he'd have to play another 83 tests and win single one just 184 to McCaw.
Into his 40s?
He played late into 30s and was still scoring 60-metre tries against the All Blacks. A wing slash second row slash eight.
Yeah, so that's where the next record cap holder is going. I'd say, isn't it a shame that Faletau is so injury-prone?
Yeah.
Because that would be the guy.
Could be the guy.
Well, maybe Billy.
Yeah.
He's had a few problems with injuries.
But they're always, tell you what, they're always snapped bones and that's encouraging. So like if it was repeat shoulders coming undone
or knee reconstruction,
it's just a forearm.
Snap.
You can get a bit of metal.
Yeah,
do
I mean
the
that,
job.
That's a carpentry problem.
It's mechanically simple.
Yeah,
and they are predictable timescales, whereas ankle ligament damage or knee ligament damage,
they're all bad.
Less predictable timescales.
So there's some in-depth rugby analysis for you.
We somehow got lost off from the New Zealand game.
Looking ahead, should we just cast our mind onto the Champions Cup final before we're done?
Well, yes. It sounds reasonable.
We heard how JP Doyle thinks it will go. I think Exeter are going to win this.
So
they beat down to lose.
They did.
They're absolutely battered to lose.
Now, one thing that does go against Exeter, and I mentioned it before, is just the attritional nature of their fixture schedule. So they battered that Bath team, but in order to bat that Bath team, they've put themselves through the mill because that Bath team is physical.
That's fair.
Conversely, I don't know if either of you saw the lineup for Racing 92 versus Toulouse, and it was a total beating.
Right.
So Racing have had a week off, whereas Exeter... I'm certain they will definitely lose Ollie Woodburn. They were already missing Jack Noel. I hope
Joe Simmons, as you said before, Tim, I hope he plays, but I don't know. Johnny Hill might get a knock on the door from the sighting commissioner from that ruck clear out on the back of...
He was dealt with and given yellow card at the time.
Yeah.
And I don't think it will. Nah, I don't think
yellow
they'll
card,
do that.
They're fine.
I'm a little bit surprised. I don't know if either of you saw the Ian Henderson red card this weekend in the 78th minute against Ospreys when the game was already done. But there was similarities between the two. Both were binding onto a ruck, failure to bind onto a ruck, joining a ruck with no attempt to bind, where the shoulder made contact with the head neck area. The Johnny Hill one, there was a lot more fuss, but it was to the back of the head neck area compared to
I loved the effect of that. I thought Luke Pearce, Wayne Barnes TMO, I thought they nailed that.
I could have been a good squad
with Courtney Lawsier.
Definitely, I talked it all through, was brilliant.
I'm going to Marseille this Friday.
Why? What happens there?
Well, there's a little place 20 minutes outside Marseille, is Aix-en-Provence, which is where the Challenge Cup final is.
Can you bring back some rosé, please?
Only if I can get it in duty free.
Why? Because you can't get it in.
Can't take liquid. Oh, I can buy hold. If you want to pay for hold luggage, I can do that for you. Oh,
100 quid.
Yeah, you're too kind. You're too kind.
Tim, we swore after our last time in Marseille,
we are never going to Marseille again. Well, I'm going to Marseille Airport.
Okay.
And then I'm driving from there to Aix-en-Provence, whatever. It's a little town just outside Marseille where the Challenge Cup final is.
Oh, the Challenge Cup. That's the one you're doing.
Nice.
Why are they sending all the talent to the Challenge Cup?
I don't know. You'll have to ask who.
Maybe they're trying to really push the competition this year.
I think I'm the only person basically going down there because it's going to be done in the studio. I'm a human shield for everyone else.
You're like the concussion boy in broadcasting.
I'm BT Sports concussion boy.
What do they call them in Chernobyl? Was it bio drones? Chernobyl that they sent.
Bio drones. Who do we have who's disposable? He's a Rockefeller. Yeah, send him.
But,
oh, wonderful.
So actually, when's the kickoff on Saturday? Because I might miss it on the plane.
Oh, is it? I want to say 4.
If it's 4 o'clock, I'm okay. I'm all right.
Coming back.
Yeah, I might miss the final.
So what are your...
Friday night, 4:45 is the kickoff.
Oh, beautiful. I think my plane lands at Manchester Airport at 4.
Beautiful. Oh, yeah, you can easily get home.
Have you got restrictions?
I might miss 10 minutes of the brilliant build-up on BT Sport, though, so I'll have to record it and not find anything out so I can watch the full...
When you go to Provence, that's where you're going,
yeah.
What are your restrictions?
Basically, part of the deal is I get an exemption from quarantining on return so long as... I basically do nothing. It was like when going to Paris the other week. Just do nothing. Stay in your hotel. Go to the airport.
So if you go to Paris now, apparently all the bar staff, all the people who are losing their jobs because of these ridiculous laws, they're making cocktails on the metro in protest.
Well, Paris has just closed
all the
bars and restaurants.
Yeah, so
again, for
the most ridiculous nonsense. Is that you're not allowed to have fun. Everything which is not... The only thing you're allowed to do is work.
I'm going to Peckham for a game of cricket.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Cricket.
Tell you what, I know everyone mocks you when you say Blitz spirit because for some reason it's nationalistic. But of course, lockdowns are nationalistic in their very definition. But that was a real bit of like British spirit. A bit of a cricket being played.
That could only happen here.
Yeah. I absolutely love that. It also shows what a farce letting everyone out of the pubs at 10 o'clock is. When we were at Bath, it was like the Wild West.
Yeah, the 10 o'clock idea just seems so ill thought through. Have you seen the pictures of the Tube? Which I've been on the Tube a fair bit over the last couple of months, as you will have been as well, Tim.
Yeah.
It's generally been dead, except for 10 p.m.
Yeah.
When you're just funnelling everyone into these tubes underground.
Totally. Now, linking this back to rugby, a couple of weeks ago... In fact, it might have been last weekend, I can't remember. But Rob Baxter said, I got it wrong on the whole coronavirus testing, fair enough. And that's the one thing that, yeah, they go, Rob Baxter's a fine example, and you see it in rugby, people actually willing to hold their hands up and go, I got it wrong, now I've got a different opinion. Just, I wish our leaders would look to rugby a little bit more. It's okay to say, do you know what, got that wrong.
Time to lock myself up in jail.
Or... let's change that, because actually we tried that and it didn't work, so...
Hey, yeah. I wonder if anyone's going to change their opinion on transgender rugby.
Meaty topic to get into. So quickly, I'm going for Exeter.
I want to sit on the fence like JP. Give me Exeter.
I can't call it. Give me Paris.
I really have to do this.
I hope they do. Really, I'll be supporting them like mad, but Paris.
For their kit alone, they don't deserve to win, but I think they will.
If it was a kit, give me Paris, but in the art and sort of rugby, give me Exeter Chiefs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Has anyone read the transgender stuff?
I've read the headlines. I couldn't drag myself to read the 45-page report.
I unsurprisingly was relying on you to read the 45-page.
I feel would, but no.
I couldn't. So I read Ross Tucker's very well-informed tweets on it.
However, lower down, there will be flexibility shown for
individual use.
Individual teams and who their participants have the flexibility at lower than professional level, but at elite level. Unfortunately for transgender athletes, they will not have the option to compete.
Trans women.
Correct.
A few things on this. I mean, a lot of money was wasted, I think, studying something which we all knew anyway. I mean, I don't need a study to show me how many moons there are. I don't need to see a study to see what fan castles in the right tide. I just know. And this would be where we are. First of all, I am very happy that this has been sorted. I think it's good. But I'm also very sad athletes that will be excluded from international competition. Because I 99% of the time, it should not be a case that a man can transition to a woman and then, you know, run all over them. But I am sure that there's going to be a situation, a very, very tiny situation. It's conceivable to me that there is a situation where this can happen. And I think having the flexibility, I mean, by definition, in this case, they couldn't be elite athletes. But
the science and the data is that people who transition post-puberty and have the benefit of puberty as a male, it's fair and unsafe. You've already highlighted the most important thing, which this is a really difficult thing for anyone who's actually going through it. I actually disagree with you. I understand why you're saying this research wasn't necessary, but I think because it is such a contentious issue, to start off very open-minded as World Rugby, collect all the different stakeholders' opinions and evidence, and then display their decision with the rationale of evidence behind it is necessary so that people at least feel heard, even if it's not the answer they want.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I guess there's that angle. I think that it is good to have the flexibility, because if I was to be put in an unsafe situation to play, I'd want the decision to rest with me. You know, if in community rugby there was for whatever the situation was, hey, do you want this guy to play? It might be dangerous. I think that should be my decision. Should be the women's decision in their own game if they want to do this. There's no shame in saying no, but there should be some flexibility, because I can legitimately see a time where, you know, a trans woman could play and it be of not danger. It's for them to decide.
It could mean, yeah, I agree, flexibility is okay, but it could potentially be hypothetically difficult situations down the line if you had a 6'5". And a 5'5", would it be unfair if you said yes to one and no to another?
Look, if Shirley Grewcock shows up or Sharon Otoji, the answer is no, right? But there is going to be a situation where, you know, it is just able to happen, and I think if it is able to happen, it should happen. But for the majority of cases, it shouldn't. And the flexibility is key, because having an edict from up top or whatnot, and you know, people say, well, what about the elite game, why is there no flexibility there? Well, because by definition, the individual's not going to be good enough to play elite level rugby. It's kind of, you know, a given.
Yeah, and just on some of the science, because Tim, I'm very much with you in that it is good for everyone's peace of mind and understanding of the logic behind this, that World Rugby have
show their working.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been, I mean, Ross Tucker, who we've spoken about before on this, has done a huge amount of work. And while there is a 45-page report that if you want to go and read it, you can do, there are also some simple FAQs and some well put together by Ross Tucker showing some of the logic. And one of them is, so the previous assumption that was made by not just World Rugby, but the Olympic Committee, IOC, and others, was that having men, once a man has transitioned to a woman,
A suppression in testosterone will be sufficient to reduce the performance.
Twelve months.
Performance gain. Yeah, exactly. So we reduced that woman's testosterone to that of the normal female range. And the science that is shown as part of this on that thinking, it just highlights that as totally, totally incorrect. The advantages... I've got them in front of me. The
bone
list
here: bone density, muscle mass, the width of the shoulders, the levers, the
total body
power
mass,
generation,
lean mass, muscle volume, strength, power, running speed. The reduction of the performance is nowhere near as great as the initial advantage in performance. And this is taking.
Isn't it something that like you still retain 80% of the advantage?
It ranges on those different ones, but yeah, if you take, say, the first one of this list, or let's take the second one, actually, because that's quite an important one. Lean mass. Men, on average, enjoy a 45% advantage over women, because they are both bigger and generally leaner. And there is, from this 12-month drop in testosterone to normal female range, there is a 4-5% drop compared to that 45% advantage. Yeah. So you're still retaining, 90%, 80, 90% of that initial advantage.
Yeah, I mean, with respect, I could have told you that.
it's a really difficult point. And just for once, I mean, it's for anyone that, for the people that are put into the position of having to make this decision about someone, and if someone really loves rugby, that's all we care about, because we love rugby.
Yeah.
And that's what it's all about at the end of the day. And it's it's on an individual level, every bit of compassion and love and a hope that you can take part in rugby as much as possible. But for once, it's nice to be able to talk about rugby taking a leadership position and having real clarity and showing the way. Because in so many elements of rugby, the leadership is just a mess.
And other things that World Rugby do as well. And from a PRL
for a sport that is so good at developing leadership qualities, it's incredible how bad the leadership is.
Really is. So this is something that I think...
Astounding,
World Rugby,
actually.
World Rugby has done very, very well.
There's clarity, there's nuance, it's been communicated well, it's been conducted in a very sensitive way. It won't be the decision that everyone will...
You know what I got? This is the most crazy argument. I mean, this just blows my mind. All of you are absolutely spot on. Just humour me for 1 second here. Which blows my mind is that not allowing trans women to play rugby is sexist, because it denies women who play at elite level the opportunity to have their Jonah Lomu moment rising up to the greatest challenge. I cannot comprehend how monumentally stupid you would need to be to make that argument. You would need to make a similar argument that it's unfair. Just throw a ball in there. Type ball. Ball.
Yeah, that is not argument here.
Yeah, and
which is not new.
In the Roscoe Pool Times, a felt argument that you don't penalise Michael Phelps because you've got longer levers, longer arms, and bigger hands and bigger feet. That is not a sport. Rugby advantage on does no need to freestyle final swimming freestyle final, long arms or short arms. But it is segregated into men versus women because of the aforementioned benefits of mass, size, muscle, power.
The only argument I am sympathetic to at all is the social argument, like the discrimination argument, that they should be allowed to play because they should be allowed to play. I mean, that is the only argument, is they should be allowed to play because they should be allowed to play. Nothing else sways me. On a personal level, their personal plight persuades me far more than it's sexist or... Yeah. Something like there's big men and small men, which is just ludicrous.
And I will, and you two have both mentioned it very well, but I will just repeat the point that, like, for any individuals who, are going to be affected by this, this is preventing them from playing the form of rugby that they want. I really empathise with them.
Yeah, agree.
Because that is a horrible position to be in. I hope that they can see that this is done with the best intentions and done from both, as you said before, Tim, both a position of science but also a position of safety and nuance. And it would be horrible to be in that position, and I hope there are very few. And I hope anyone who is in that position can still enjoy the game that we all love. Mm. And because there are other ways. Like I've not played competitive rugby for a number of years.
Pathetic.
But I'm still very much involved in the game, and I hope everyone can still find their place in the game, because that is the most important thing to all of us, I think.
Amen. Beautiful sentiment to end a long but great podcast. Thanks again to JP Doyle. Nice one, JB.
Nice one, Tim.
Nice one, Phil.
Thank you, Tim.
He's at Jay Beardmore on Twitter. I'm at Cocker. We're at Rugby Podcast. And next week, we'll try and sort out streaming this thing on Facebook, YouTube and the like.
And also, watch out on my social media channels, because I am trying desperately to get an article published and nobody will publish it.
No one's biting.
No one will publish this damn thing. But hopefully, I'll get it published some point next week.
No one's had a little nibble. Are you not tempted to become a blogger?
Yeah, go on.
Rugby
vlogger. No, thank you.
Watch this space. Right, nice one. Enjoy the Champions Cup final, and we'll catch you soon.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.